Hello and Happy New Year. Welcome to a brand new episode of the Scared to Dance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who have DJed our club nights, as well as those who have created our film nights. Today, on this special New Year's Day episode, we are joined by James Dean Bradfield from Manic Street Preachers. He talks about Escape from History, the documentary film about the making of the band's acclaimed album, Everything Must Go. In autumn 1995, Manic Street Preachers decamped to a remote studio in Normandy, with producer Mike Hedges to begin recording their fourth album. Just 8 months after the disappearance of their bandmate and lyricist Rich Edwards, Manic Street Preachers faced an uncertain future. What emerged from those sessions was the astonishing Everything Must Go, the critically acclaimed album that propelled the band into the mainstream and has since become a modern classic. With singles A Design for Life, Kevin Carter, Everything Must Go, and Australia, the album became one of the defining records of the 90s, and to date has sold over a million copies. James Dean Bradfield was joined on stage at the Scared to Dance Film Night by the director Kieran Evans, and the discussion was hosted by the music journalist Robin Turner. Hello, and welcome to the Scared to Dance Film Night here at Pitch House Central. If you haven't been to one of our film nights before, we show music-related films and documentaries. We were delighted to have Nicky Wire here last year. Who came to that one? For the Holy Bible, yeah? Well, tonight we've got James Dean Bradfield. So he'll be in conversation with Robin Turner and the director, Kieran Evans, afterwards. So please do stick around for that. I believe Escape from History has never been shown in the cinema before. So you are in for an absolute treat. So I will be back at the end of the film. And in the meantime, just enjoy the film. And yeah, enjoy.
Hi, my name is Robin Turner. I am a sort of long-term Manix kind of...
Collaborator.
Hanger-oner.
Collaborator.
Kieran Evans look-alike. He did slightly better for me. He comes from a more posher part of Wales where they breed them bigger and stronger and...
better genes.
And we are going to talk through the film. It's funny because I was watching the film the other day. Kieran sent me a link to it. And one of the things that sort of took me back, because obviously these things are historical and, you know, you find yourself filtering back through time. And the embassy, the hotel that you were staying in on the night that Richie left.
Yeah,
we were in the bar until about 3 a.m, just the two of us, drinking, listening to those demos, and getting pissed. And you had like a 7 o'clock leave time, I think.
I think 7, 8, something like that. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did wring it dry in the bar. I'd asked Richie to come out that night. I'd asked him twice, and he said he might go and see a film. So I used the backup guy, Robin Turner, and you came and we just rang it dry. And then obviously subsequently the next morning is when everything happened, obviously.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's interesting looking back at it historically, because one of the things that struck me, which I hadn't thought about for a long time, was how close it kind of came almost to an end. Like Sean talks about it at the start, the Astoria gigs at the end of the gigs, you wrecked everything on the last night. Yeah. Rob talks about meeting and the way that Sony, you know, the way that Sony are talking about it, and it's funny to think about how, you know, you think about the Holy Bible and how that album is now perceived and, critically lauded as a record.
Yeah.
Yet at the time, it felt like that maybe wasn't the case.
It's hard kind of looking back all the time and talking about yourself. And obviously, we've just done the book with Keith Cameron. I thought that was the end of talking, but apparently not. And you got to be careful to try and recall the right memories. I think your memories do start to get juggled up a bit, and you do start to edit yourself. You start to make yourself a bit more literate in terms of being emotional in the past than you actually were, because you've got to remember, you know, we were still quite young. I don't think we had the best ways of dealing with things. Oh, by the way, as an aside, congratulations to Kieran on the film, the director. His crowning glory is I've never, ever, ever seen somebody convince Sean to talk that fucking much. And then he stopped. That's it. He just stopped after that.
Until the next time.
Well, we
he's never spoken to me.
He barely speaks to me. But anyway, I think, you know, we were coming out the back. We felt like a big cult band. We were, even though we were on Top of the Pops, and we were doing tours, like, you know, less at the Montford Hall, medium-sized venues, as you like to joke about from that Snub TV interview. But even though we were doing quite well, and we'd been on Top of the Pops, and we had a certain notoriety, it felt like perhaps this was as far as we could go. And this felt like a bit of, like the Dodgem car, like, you know, come on, your time is up. You know, with the Astoria gigs and with Richie's disappearance, I could feel that kind of voice going, come on, your time's up, you eccentric taff, Snow. You've done your stuff and you've blazed a little trail, but that's it. That's as far as you go. There was a little bit of a nagging voice in my head that was, the game was up. I think I had that emotion, but I was kind of ignoring it. Sean was quite grim. Obviously, Richie was complicated. I can't quite remember what Nick's reaction to everything was after the Astoria gigs. But I just all remember just wipe out when Richie went missing. You know, we didn't really know what to feel. There was anger. We've said all this in the film, you know, there was anger, there was confusion, and there was frustration because I felt like we were going to write our best songs. We'd done Motorcycle, we'd done Motown, we'd worked with amazing people. You know, we'd had so much luck on our side. Philip, Martin, Michael, Jeff, Jeff and Martin from Heavenly, you know, Scott, Terry, so many people we'd worked with, but it felt like our luck had run out. Now, I remember just in bed one night, just counting it all up, thinking, is the game up? So I think the only thing I thought was, I need more words. That's the only way forward. Nick needs to start writing again. And that's all I can remember, to be honest.
So Kieran, so when you decided to look at this period of this period of the band's career, what was your take on it as from an outside perspective? You know, how the band were, well, I mean, how the band went from there to there in what is actually short space of time. I remember it feeling like a long space of time at the time, but
yeah.
It's less than 2 years, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, basically in like 2015, James asked me, would I go on a trek with him to Patagonia with Sean and to do a fundraiser?
The shop.
Sorry?
The shop.
The shop. Patagonia.
The place, Patagonia.
The place, Patagonia. And I knew that there was going to be these anniversary tours coming up and all that kind of stuff. And Wired asked me whether I'd be up for like designing the like visual show and all that kind of stuff. And we were trekking around, you know, amazing parts of Patagonia. And we were with a bunch of people who were very nice, but didn't really want to have conversations with them. So I ended up spending a lot of time just walking with Sean and talking. And we just started talking about this particular period, you know, and Sean was very, you know, as you could tell in the film, he was incredibly open about it. And I just kind of had it in the back of my head, I'll just store that. And then, you know, when we were talking about the shows and all that kind of stuff, I said, this might be an opportunity to make a film about this particular period, but from a slightly different perspective, you know, kind of like, you know, I'd watched a couple of BBC documentaries that had covered this period before, but I always felt that when you put a band in front of a film crew with lights and all that kind of stuff, they're never going to tell you anything that you really want to dig around in. And I just felt that I think I had the confidence of the guys, and I kind of just kept on nagging a bit, really. I just basically nagged Wire to kind of like let me film the Holy Bible tour. I pitched him this idea of like, I'll shoot myself. And then I kind of went, and he went, well, how are you going to do everything? Let's go. I said, I'll shoot myself. It'll just be me, you know, interviewing Phil, you, James and Sean, and there will be no other cameras. So, you know, feel free to open up, and away they went, you know, and I did it. And then I just kind of just thought, you know, we've got a film here. We've got something that's really, really fascinating, you know. And then I think it was Wire or James said, it's important to kind of start talking to the people who were there at the time, you know, Terry, Martin, people like that, just to kind of like, because I don't think their voices had really been heard before. And it was really, you know, I remember interviewing Martin. It was incredibly emotional. It was like, you know, he welled up quite a few times because it was, you know, it's a trauma that I think is held within the Mannix camp. It's something that hadn't been really explored. So, you know, it felt, I don't want to use the word cathartic or anything like that, but it felt like it was the right time for people to talk about it because obviously, you know, there was the anniversary tour coming up. Yeah, and that's how it came about, really. That's it, really. Me being a bit belligerent, bullying Why. I mean, I remember the most amazing thing I remember about the whole thing is I went down to Cardiff and I think Faster Studios was closing down and I did the last couple of interviews there. And I remember James doing a demo for Distant Colours in the background and Sean was up for it. And Why was making every excuse known to man to not do the interview and all that kind of stuff. And I stupidly went out the night before and had a curry and I spilt all my curry over my trousers. And he just found that hilarious because I had this massive dark stain in the wrong part of my body on my trouser thing. And that just kind of made him laugh. And then away we went and that was it. So, you know, if you ever want to interview Nicky Wire in the future, spill a curry on your front of your trousers and you thought you might get an interesting angle on it. And on that note, I'm going to exit the building.
Yeah. No, Mr. Nicky Wire is coming. So in the film the recording in the House of the Woods is that's obviously a starting point for what happened. I think I remember at the time you saying that Richie wanted it to sound like a cross between Pantera and Screamadelica.
Nine Inch Nails as well, mate.
Right. Yeah.
Very achievable.
Yes. But what was recorded there that became, you know, there's the pieces that ended up on the album. And I was listening to the demo of Small Black Flowers that's on there, and the fact that it sounds, the recorded version on the record sounds so similar to that demo.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether there was a part of keeping that purity was he'd loved that track so much, whether the purity between demo and finish.
The microphone's glitched. I didn't mention Gillian and Kathy as well earlier on. Obviously when we pulled into the car park at the MC Hotel directly from House in the Woods, that evening that we've talked about already. I have said before, we pulled into the car park, which is underground. It was, you know, very parallax view, very All the President's Men kind of car park. And just literally the Small Black Flowers finished. And he went, that's the song that I really like, which tacitly felt to me, that's the only song I like, kind of thing. You know? And he wasn't so brutal as to say anything else, but I did read between those lines. I may be wrong, maybe right. I think he liked a bit of No Surface or Feeling because it had a tiny bit of the Pumpkins element to it, and he was a big fan of the Pumpkins. But I got that feeling that he liked something that you could see where the darkness had withered away and then he died in the song, something pure had died, kind of thing. So I wasn't sure. After that moment, and it did feel like a moment because he said it very, very directly. After that moment, I remember thinking this could be a bit of a, this could be one of those albums where I suppose, you know, well, Wire said, you know, in many interviews after the Bible, you know, I let Richie run with the ball on this one. He had a vision. I remember thinking to myself, well, perhaps that's what Richie's going to say on this record, that this isn't quite my vision, but like, you know, I'm still in the band, you know. You know, Nick was, why I was very magnanimous on the Bible of saying, you know, Richie's written 70% of these lyrics, you know, and this is vision, lyrically. So I thought perhaps I'll switch around now. The polarity of that will switch around to perhaps Nick writing more words. then when we came to do the master version, I think we were careful not to change it too much in terms of the structure or the words, though there's a few tweaks. But that's where Mike Hedges and Ian Grimble, so Ian Grimble was the engineer and Mike was the producer. That's where real production comes out, where it just felt so full of quality, full of crystalline clear detail. It was reserved. He got the right performance out of me. And he got Frank Sinatra's harp player. Can't believe I've forgotten her name. Fuck, sorry. She did an amazing job. It was just two passes and she just did it. And she was lovely. She said, oh, I love this song. You know, this song could have, is very 60s. And I remember saying something about The Spider and the Fly, which is a Stones song, which I had in my head too. So, yeah, we were careful to be faithful to it because of what Richie had said beforehand, definitely. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a bit about Design for Life, because obviously it's the pivotal point of the record, and it's just such a, I don't know, it's a pivotal point of your life, isn't it? I've read it described as Trojan Horse Manix, a radio friendly, milkman hummable song that delivers a very clear political message. I just wondered, how does it feel writing something like that after all the things that happened? Was that cathartic? Was that redemption?
Well, kind of number one, why I was writing in a very different way. He was writing within some kind of meter, which was more easily sung. That was obvious straight away. There's still lines in there which literally hit you in the face, you know. You know, if right here in my dirty face, right here in my pretty face. There's still lines that just, and that's really struck me. I was playing with the boys the other day in the studio. We're going through lots of old songs like Next I to Leave Moscow, Rose in the Hospital, just lots of old stuff that we haven't played for ages. And, one of the first lines in Rose in the Hospital is, Rose in the Hospital, I tried to pull my fingernails out. Ooh, hit. And so you've got this song where, you know, we hang our hopes on it, but it's still got lines in there like, if I had a bottle right here in my dirty face, it's still very, very oppositional. It still kind of startles you a bit as a lyric. But the song, you know, when I got those lyrics and, you know, I thought it was so succinct that we didn't really need another verse either. We just changed one word in the next verse from dirty to pretty, obviously. I remember thinking it was about, you know, bust and boom economy, economic policies. It was about a kind of the long traditional tirade to kind of like, you know, keep the working classes in their place in terms of their ambitions and their spending power, and keep them reined with fear in terms of just, you know, the erosion of union rights, et cetera, et cetera. It was all in there. And there was a real beautiful, gentle pride in there. Yeah, it was a proud lyric, but not like proud with your chest stuck out. It was something that glided. And I remember thinking, you know, this is it. You know, he's managed to distill it all down. You know, after coming off the back of an album like Yes, where you sometimes you're having history lessons, which I loved. But we had to take a turn somewhere else. It had to be more distilled. We had to try and repurpose everything we knew about ourselves. And this lyric did it, you know. And it did it in a really overarching kind of way, I think.
Kieran, can you remember hearing that record for the first time as a Welsh acid house head? Can you remember how the effect that
I
it
can.
Had?
Proper build up this boy was.
Not on this occasion. No, I can remember exactly where I heard it. I was in a newsagent's buying a magazine, and I think it was on Radio 1, and this is the new single from the Manic Street Preachers. And I can definitely say I've never really, and I'm not saying this just because James hit it. I've never experienced it since, but it was like being hit by a thunderbolt. I mean, literally from the first bar and the lyric, I literally stood, like the guy was... You know, I was trying to pay for my, or I'd stood, I was standing at the counter and I was about to pay. And then basically I handed over the magazine and then I was just stood and I couldn't, you know, move. I was paralyzed. And the guy kept on shouting at me, do you want to pay or not? Do you want to pay or not? And I said, I'm listening to this. I'm like, what is this? And all this kind of stuff. And it still hits me like a thunderbolt. Still hits me like a thunderbolt. We've just done a whole pile of shows, and it's still extraordinary the effect it has on people when you hear it live. So it's still extraordinary how people. We did a show in one of our shows was in Norway, which felt like it was in like a beer garden, but it wasn't. But when design came up, like about 50 people just turned towards us, like the front of house, and just started pumping their hearts like that, because we were using these visuals of like miners and all that kind of stuff, and they were just pumping their hearts and like doing that. And it's when you see that that you kind of realize how powerful that this song is, how powerful, how much it means to people, you know. And it's very rare that you get that sense of how much it means to people, you know. And yeah, it's a privilege every night sometimes to just be able to experience it. But, you know, I'd still kind of think about it like every couple of weeks about, you know, I still pinch myself, actually, that I'm working with the Manic Street Preachers. Because I think about the time in the magazine shop trying to buy a magazine and being unable, paralyzed. And, yeah, that is the power.
It's nice to hear that you were so definite about your reaction to it, because
so I wasn't pilled up, right?
No, it's cool. It's cool. I wasn't at terminals.
I wasn't at the social.
It all helps. But before we released it, you know, I remember Rob Stringer. You know, just he was like, "Boof, that's it." There were a couple of people that were close to us that weren't so sure about it, which really shook me. There was a journalist that I really respected that said he thought it just sounded like a ballad, which really shook me as well. And then we supported the Stone Roses at Wembley Arena. I remember Nick Wye was wearing a Cardiff Red Devils ice hockey top. And people were a bit shocked by that. They were like, what the fuck is this? But he's a big, you know, Red Devils fan kind of thing. Anyway, and the reaction that night when we supported the Roses wasn't great. It wasn't, you know. So I remember there were a few people that said, you know, Stringer said, no, this is amazing. But there are a few people around us that weren't quite so sure. So it's nice to hear that. It is, kind of thing.
I mean, it's a pure record, isn't it? It's kind of, I don't know. It's hard to think of people not getting it now. But yeah,
I remember the nice moment was supporting Oasis at Main Road, and then suddenly you saw that people knew more than two of our songs. You know, that kind of crowd. Yeah. They knew more than Despair, or they knew more than Motorcycle. Suddenly. Like a third of this crowd all knew this song. That was a good moment.
So Nick says on the film that a record like Everything Must Go would struggle 20 years on. That's 30 years next year, just to show our age. Thanks to the conservatism of the age. So I mean, we were talking about this a minute ago, and it's like it's hard to think about. I mean, 10 years on from that, probably an even more conservative age.
I don't know. Wye's got a way more incisive brain than mine to try and unlock what things mean in different periods and looking into the future. I'm not quite so sure. I think the sound of the record would sound quite jarring on the radio, because it's quite grandiose and it's quite emotionally incontinent. And it's kind of not emotionally incontinent, and that's not, but it is grand in its vision, and it does try to repel the assumption that people from working classes should be humble or kind of like, I don't hear that much on the radio. So I think the sound of it may jar on the radio today. But I just remember just Wye's lyrics thinking, oh, this is like a bit like Idris Davis, you know, it's not ashamed of its own identity. It's heartfelt, but it's not too earnest. There are massive boulders of refusal in there, but it's all couched in poetry. And I remember just thinking, you know, it's a bit like something from Gwalia Desert, you know, Idris Davis. It's not ashamed of itself at all. And that's why I still love that lyric, definitely. I don't know if it would have an effect now. I'm not quite sure. I haven't got the brain to figure that one out.
I'd like to interject at this point. Whilst I've been doing a little bit of archive research on a secret project that we've been working on. There's a moment in Top of the Pops because you were on Top of the Pops, four singles on Top of the Pops. And Ian Broody introduces this Australia, and he goes, "It's the fourth track from the album Everything Must Go, and everyone's a fucking." We just say everyone's a fucking, everyone's a winner, and it's like, wow, you know, kind of like. And then when you look back, it's like previous presenter was Jack D. Introducing. Then there's another guy, I think it was in Space or something like that, who's a bit off his head.
Yeah.
And the other guy was Chris, the boxer, what's his name? Eubank, that's it.
Oh, the Eubanks.
Eubank. And then you walk.
I met Chris Eubanks in a bar, and I asked him to be on. We asked him to be on the cover of one of his singles. He went, "Who are you?" And turned away
in a slightly lispy way. But then you kind of like look, and you know, the thing about it is, it's like you're on the Smash Hits Awards with Out in Debt. You know, and it's like you know, when you're on TFI Friday, and you know, it is like that kind of like what why I said, you know, it wasn't like, you know, we've taken over the mainstream. It feels like that sometimes, and it's quite an extraordinary.
Four single campaigns, remixes, B-sides.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow.
I mean, Stealth Sonic Orchestra, you know, instrumental version, not available at the moment, but I've got it on a CD. Mark Farrow's design as well. You know, everything, you know, it's an extraordinary piece of, you know, art, I think. The music and the sleeves and everything. It just, there's a kind of like a coalescing or something like that. Just something happens, and it's a beautiful thing, you know. And it was so exciting to kind of like look back at that when I was making the film about Christ. And I remember like going to see you at the Kentish Town Forum, and Liam Gallagher just runs on stage and grabs wire and all that kind of stuff. And you just,
I think, fucking hammered.
I know, you could tell. But you felt, you know, I think you felt that, you know, like Liam Gallagher's on stage with the Manics. You could feel that something was happening.
He liked No Surface or Feeling. That's what he liked.
Did he?
Yeah, he used to go, "I fucking love when it goes." I was just like, "Fucking crack on!" I love that.
Yeah,
thank
yeah.
you.
If you ever want to make a solo record, Liam, we're the guys to talk to.
The film kind of the end point of it is, or near the end, is the Brits, and so, you know, that's the long period of the film, as opposed to the, you know, going from the Astoria to recording Everything Must Go. It's like it's the extra year on the end, and that year was spectacular. It was an escalation of size of gigs, which gets to 9x in the end, and it's. I sort of wondered, you know, that how that must have felt to be propelled through that after all the stuff that's happened.
Yeah.
And then to have that, which was any band, I don't know, it's...
There is a timeline in my head where kind of it starts. And of course, you've got to be really careful because, yeah, we come out the other end. Kind of, you know, you got to be careful not to high-five yourself because we did everything despite of Richie's absence, you know, and it does bring you down. It does bring you crashing down. It brings your emotions crashing down, and you think, wow, you know, I'm high-fiving myself here, you know, two Brits and this and that, but look at what the cost was. And not saying that we were direct responsible for anything, but it felt like there was a cost. It just did. You can't deny that. But there is a timeline that I'm careful to just to look on with a bit of like some kind of sensitivity, and that is, I remember sitting in Askew Road. I was still living at Philip's house, and Terry Gould and Liz Gould were kindly putting up with me at the house in Askew Road, and I was sat watching, some might say, on Top of the Pops, which I love that song. I fucking adore that song. I think it's amazing. And I just remember it was the second appearance, I think, on Top of the Pops. And Noel just raises his guitar above his head at the end. And I don't know even know if we'd started writing Design for Life at that point. And I was just so down. I was so confused and lost about everything. Friendship, you know, abilities, where I wanted to live, whether to go back to Wales, you know, whether the group could survive, whether, you know, kind of like Richie's parents would even know how to talk to us, you know, with Richie still missing. Everything was so up for grabs emotionally. And I remember watching Noel just raise his guitar above his head and Top Pops to this song, which I loved. I just remember just getting up and just going for a walk for 4 hours just around Shepherd's Bush. I just feel utterly defeated. But I loved this song. I was haunted by this song, which I admired so much. I remember coming back and I remember just thinking, you know, it's just a song that can save us. The only thing that can save us is each other, you know, and all the people around us. And that sounds dramatic, but it did feel like that. And then you get to the timeline of the Brits and, yeah, it does feel a bit B-movie-ish sometimes. It does feel like, you know, we did, you know. But, you know, there is a price to pay. And you catch yourself in the mirror just smiling, thinking, oh, well, that's amazing. Then you realize it would have been better with the four of us. It's no doubt, you know, because we would have gone places with Richie, which would have been surprising. And Nick, you know, Wyatt pushed himself to different places lyrically, you know, but we were always to be missing that angle and that friendship. So you catch yourself in moments of glory and you go, keep a lid on it, I suppose. But the timeline was from watching that Top the Pops to the Brits. It did feel like, wow, you know, we managed to survive kind of thing.
Wow, but.
Yeah. Wow, but, yeah.
Okay, right. I think we might have hit our time limit. So,
pretty good way to end, actually.
Look, thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for everything.
Thanks very much for coming.
Thanks to James and Bradfield from Manic Street Preachers, the director Kieran Evans, and the music journalist Robin Turner for hosting the conversation at Pitch House Central. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. Next week, I've been talking to the ex-footballer and pundit Pat Nevin. We'll be discussing his career at Chelsea and Everton, his eclectic taste in music, Simple Minds, Morrissey, and his love of DJing. This podcast was produced at Third Floor Recording.